July was a good month for job creation. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update for Friday, the third day of August. Coming up, we're going to dig into this morning's jobs report. We'll hear from President Obama's chief economist. We'll also hear from a chief economist for Mitt Romney's campaign. And we will speak with a woman in the Palestinian territories who has started a radio station in order to get more women into the workforce. It's all coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This podcast is supported by Ting.com. Ting gives you big savings for mobile phone service. Try their online savings calculator and save $50 on your device purchase at marketplace.ting.com.
The U.S. economy added 163,000 jobs last month. That is the word from the Labor Department this morning. The private sector accounted for all the job creation, with 172,000 private sector jobs added. Government employment actually declined by 9,000. And the unemployment rate ticked up from 8.2% to 8.3%. For more on this, we are going to bring in our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore, who is with me in the studio now. We've also got Peter Capelli on the line. He is the director of the Center for Human Resources at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Heidi, let me start with you. What else is in this report?
Well, it's a really good report. You're seeing a lot of things have gone up. Manufacturing, healthcare, leisure, even computer systems design. So the geeks shall inherit the earth, at least in July. And what's really interesting is how granular the report is. You know, in utilities, jobs were down by 8,500 people. That's because of the Con Ed labor dispute here in New York. So, you know, it's a really good report. It shows on average we're exactly where we were last year, but it's good because we're not losing that many jobs, and that's excellent.
Peter Capelli, let me go to you. What's your initial reaction to this report? Do you agree that it's a good report?
Yeah, I think it's a good report, and it largely depends on your expectations. You know, in May, we only added 87,000 jobs, and in June, we only added 64,000 jobs. So compared to where we were, this is pretty good news.
And what about you're the author of a book, which is called Why Good People Can't Get Jobs. So I want to ask you about some of these people who've been out of work for a long time, the long-term unemployed. If the unemployment rate is ticking up from 8.2 to 8.3%, I guess that indicates more people are coming into the labor force. So will these long-term unemployed be able to get jobs at this point?
Yeah, no, that's a great point. It looks like 260,000 people who had given up, who were discouraged workers, came back in this month, which is, I suppose, a good sign. But the interesting news here is that the long-term unemployed this time, 27 weeks or more of unemployment, that dropped a lot, 185,000 people less than last month in that category. So that's pretty interesting news.
Anything concerning in this to you, Peter Capelli?
Well, you know, I think in the long term, we do have a concern about the way employers are hiring, and that is that they're looking for somebody who can come right in to do the job, as demonstrated by the fact that they're currently doing the same job someplace else. And that typically meant they want to hire people, only people who are already employed someplace else. And I think that's been a concern for a while, but this time actually it looks pretty good because the percentage of those people who are unemployed who are getting jobs long term seems to be looking up.
And Heidi, let me come back to you, because earlier this week we had the news that the Fed is going to hold off for now on any additional economic stimulus, in part because they wanted to see what economic data comes out over the next little bit here. What do you think this jobs report does to the chances that the Fed is going to step in?
Well, this is a really positive report, so it reduces the chances that the Fed will feel pressure for stimulus. And it adds to other positive indicators we've had recently. Housing looks like it's hit a bottom. Consumer confidence is bizarrely high. We don't know why. But all of those are really good indicators, and so it tells the Fed maybe they don't need to step in just yet, until the next bad jobs report.
Does it look like this could be a turning point and that this global slowdown we've been talking about is maybe slowing down, if you will? I mean, are things getting better, or is it, are we putting too much into just one jobs report?
Right. A slowdown of a slowdown is improvement, right? I think that we'll have to watch it. It's certainly encouraging, but you want to watch the trends over, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 months.
Marketplace New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore and Peter Capelli, who is the director of the Center for Human Resources at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, for some reaction from the White House now, let's bring in Alan Krueger. He is chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisers. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, so how would you characterize this jobs report?
You know, every month when the jobs report comes out, I try to look at it in the context of other information that's coming in. And I think we see a picture of an economy that's slowly healing. And when the president came to office, we were losing over 800,000 jobs a month. This month, we've added 163,000 jobs and 4.5 million over the last 29 months. So we're slowly digging our way out of the deep hole that the recession created. And there are steps we can take to build on the progress that we've made.
But the unemployment rate did tick up to 8.3%.
Yeah, any increase in the unemployment rate is unwelcome. And I think we need to recognize that the high level of unemployment, which is unacceptable, is a result of the deep recession. And that's why we need more job growth. That's why the president is focused on making proposals to Congress to strengthen job growth, such as the American Jobs Act, which would create jobs for construction workers, building infrastructure, fixing our highways and roads and ports, as well as funds for state and local governments to retain school teachers and first responders. And if you look at today's report, areas of weakness were construction workers and local government education jobs. So those are areas where Congress can act right now to create more jobs in the short run.
Well, what's the president doing to get this Jobs Act passed at this point? Is he having the Republican leaders over to the White House? Is he trying to make a new push on this stuff?
The president has been pressing since he made the proposals in the American Jobs Act almost a year ago. Some have passed. Importantly, Congress did pass the 2 percentage point payroll tax reduction, which is helping families keep more money after taxes. That's helping to support the economy, and he continues to press Congress to take actions that will support the economy. This afternoon, or rather this morning, the president is holding an event here at the White House with middle-class families to highlight the importance of extending the middle-class tax cuts to prevent a typical middle-class family from seeing their taxes go up by around $2,000 next year.
Do you think that the unemployment rate is going to dip down below 8% by the time we reach Election Day?
I can tell you that if the proposals the president has made were passed, I would expect the unemployment rate to come down further. We made a forecast, my office together with the Treasury Department and Office of Management and Budget, on how the economy would evolve under the president's policies, and that forecast does predict that the unemployment rate would continue to fall if Congress passed the balanced approach the president has proposed to addressing our deficit, as well as the short-run programs to strengthen job growth, such as investing more in infrastructure, keeping teachers and first responders on the job.
Alan Krueger, chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, for another take on this now, let's bring in Glenn Hubbard. He is the dean of Columbia University's Graduate School of Business. He's also an economic advisor to the Mitt Romney campaign. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, how would you characterize this morning's jobs report?
Well, I think it's fair to say that the jobs report is pretty much where we've been in the labor market of having the economy stuck in first gear. And we've had unemployment above 8% since February 2009. That's really the longest spell in the post-war period. So I think we've got a lot of work to do.
But 163,000 jobs is obviously much better than we've seen in the last several months.
Yes, and that just shows how our expectations have been lowered. In a vigorous recovery, if you compare this recovery to, say, the 74-75 recession or 81-82, we should be seeing jobs numbers more in the 200,000 to 300,000 mark, not where we are. So we should all be happy every time an employment report has any good news. But I think it would be very much of a stretch to say this report tells us we're out of the woods.
Well, of course, the White House response to that would be we're in the worst recession since the Great Depression, which started during the Bush administration.
Well, we did have a terrible recession, but the White House may want to go back and look at history, because financial historians will tell you that it's not baked in the cake that recoveries, at least from U.S. financial crises, have been necessarily slow. And the fact that every year the White House has issued a rosy forward-looking scenario only to have that dashed says it must not believe the financial crisis story quite either.
Well, then what would Governor Romney do if he were to become president to change this recovery and make it better without going back to the kinds of policies that created the bubble that burst in the first place?
It's a great question. I mean, the first thing is to decide what you want to focus on as president. And I think for Governor Romney, that really is about economic growth and job creation. Once you've decided what you focus on, what do you do about it? I think in Governor Romney's case, it's first of all, let's stop the policy uncertainty that we've been seeing in tax policy, in regulatory policy, in spending policy. And then second, affirmatively, what do you do? We need a bold tax reform that's pro-growth, and we need to make sure that we put the budget on a path toward fiscal sustainability, while at the same time doing intelligent regulatory policy, energy policy, and trade policy. Those things will get the economy going.
Glenn Hubbard is the dean of the Columbia University Graduate School of Business. He's also an advisor to the Romney campaign. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
My pleasure.
Well, if you look into this morning's jobs report, you'll see that manufacturing jobs accounted for 25,000 of the new jobs in July. And it turns out a big part of the growth in this country's manufacturing base is in plastics. From WCPN in Cleveland, Brian Bull reports.
At Venture Plastics in Newton Falls, Ohio, sales VP Brian Osborne points out plastic components being made for cars.
These parts go on the interior vehicle. They're down near the sides of your seat.
Half of a new car is plastic. That's 400 pounds of material, 20 times more than the amount used 50 years ago.
In fact, all your chrome parts on a vehicle are actually plastic parts that get chromed. They're not metal.
In 2009, roughly 8.5 million cars were made in the U.S. But with the recession's effects easing up, Osborne projects almost double that amount will be made next year. Plastics aren't the only material seeing a bump, and the increases aren't just happening in the automotive sector. Ohio Aluminum Industries in Cleveland makes parts for the Boeing 787 Dreamliner and the Airbus A380. VP of Sales, Steve Swarthout.
Basically, Boeing and Airbus can't build planes fast enough.
Aerospace has also boosted titanium. It's as light as aluminum and as strong as steel. The International Titanium Association says after the recession, there's been a spike in orders for airframes, among other things.
We're optimistic that with continuation of the aviation, medical, petrochemical markets, that we'll continue to have slight increases.
At GNS Titanium in Wooster, Ohio, company president Mitch Bowers roams his plant in a golf cart. GNS makes a variety of products, ranging from springs and fasteners for the Airbus to shrapnel used in Sidewinder missiles. Looking forward, Bowers says there's room to grow.
When we bought the land out here, we projected to put in enough space to double the company.
Bowers says business has improved enough that he's brought back 4 of the 10 people his company laid off a few years ago. In Wooster, Ohio, I'm Brian Bull for Marketplace.
There's some troubling news out of Europe this morning. The parent company of British Airways and Iberia made the startling announcement that it's preparing contingency plans for a possible Spanish exit from the euro. This comes just a day after the head of the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, failed to impress global markets with his plan to save the euro. And when he resorted to the insect world to bolster the eurozone, entomologists weren't too impressed either. Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story from London.
Of all Mario Draghi's recent remarks, this was the most curious. He said the euro is like a bumblebee. Under the law of aerodynamics, the bumblebee shouldn't fly, said Draghi, but it does. And he claimed it's the same with the euro. When it was launched, it confounded the critics, took off and didn't crash. But Draghi admits something's changed. The currency's having a bumpy ride. He said the bumblebee will have to mutate into a honeybee. Jonathan Neal, a professor of entomology from Indiana, says that's not reassuring.
If we wait for a bumblebee to magically transform into a honeybee, we will wait a long time. They diverged evolutionarily millions of years ago.
Maybe that was Mario's real message, the real sting in the tail. It could be many years before the eurozone is buzzing again. From London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Well, while we're in London, let's talk about the Olympics. Imagine sleeping through your alarm clock on the day you're supposed to compete in the Olympics. That is what happened to a British weightlifter named Jack Oliver this week. He was supposed to get up at 6, but he woke up at 7:05 instead to the sound of his trainer banging on the door. He did make it to his event and amazingly set a new personal record.
This podcast is supported by Ting, the new mobile service that makes sense, bringing billing clarity, usability, and savings to mobile phone users. Ting bills megabytes, minutes, and text messages separately. Ting has no premiums or penalties. You don't pay for more than you use. Businesses and families can have unlimited devices on an account. Save money and better manage your mobile phone usage. Save $50 on your device at marketplace.ting.com. That's marketplace.ting.com.
Procter & Gamble, which makes Tide, Spick & Span, Crest, and a whole host of other household products, is reporting a drop in quarterly sales this morning. And as our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports, a big hedge fund could be maneuvering to clean P&G's house.
It might be tempting to draw a comparison to circling buzzards, but when an activist investor swoops in over a struggling company, shareholders often see that as a hopeful sign. P&G chief Bob McDonald has been looking vulnerable since his last earnings conference call in April, when analysts like Citigroup's Wendy Nicholson voiced impatience with the consumer product giant's withering performance.
Where is the mea culpa taking responsibility for the weak numbers as opposed to saying, not our fault, it's just really tough out there?
Since then, activist investor Bill Ackman bought nearly $2 billion worth of P&G shares. It's a time-tested approach. Find a company that needs fixing, buy an influential stake, and hopefully shake things up for the better. Professor Charles Elson has watched the rise of activist investors over the past two decades. He heads the University of Delaware's Center for Corporate Governance.
They've been very successful, not only at creating change in the companies in which they invest, but also creating shareholder value.
Elson views activist investors as beneficial because they push executives toward more efficient and profitable business practices. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
DirecTV says it had its first ever quarterly loss of customers last quarter, and it appears those customers are not flocking to the competition. Time Warner Cable also lost subscribers for the 10th quarter in a row. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports now on the changing business of pay TV.
More than 400,000 households have dropped their cable or satellite TV service this year. Paul Palumbo is an analyst with AccuStream iMedia Research. He says part of it is a generational shift. He says more people age 18 to 35 have game boxes connected to their TVs. They're using them to watch shows through online services like Netflix and Hulu.
What you see here is just totally preference-driven programming. They're not going to subscribe to everything and then watch what they choose to watch. They're going to use their points of access that they know well and choose the programming that they like.
The second quarter is typically the slowest time for the business as people move and college kids drop their service for the summer. DirecTV also lost customers as it tightened its credit standards for subscribers. At the same time, cable companies profited from demand for streaming video. Time Warner and Comcast both reported higher earnings this week thanks to sales of high-speed internet service. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
To another TV story of sorts, this Sunday night, NASA's Curiosity rover will be landing on Mars. And the $2.5 billion mission will be getting some big-time publicity. The landing will be broadcast live on the huge Toshiba screen in New York's Times Square. Sally Herships has that story.
Just in case you didn't know, NASA isn't allowed to advertise. So when Toshiba offered the Space Administration the chance to broadcast in pricey Times Square, it was all systems go.
This is the American Space Agency. This is the American people's space agency.
Sarah Ramsey works with NASA. She says this is the hardest mission NASA has ever attempted in the history of robotic planetary exploration. So the agency wants people to see it and to know where their tax dollars are going. In this case, to Mars with rovers.
It is their best-selling hit.
Dr. Mary Lynn Dittmar is a consultant in space, the industry. She says in 2004, when NASA also sent rovers to Mars, she did a study where she found consumer interest in the rovers to be near adoration.
Two little critters that just kept on going. There were windstorms. There was dust all over the panels. They were declared dead on more than one occasion. And so there was drama.
Dittmar says with all the federal budget problems, it's likely NASA is counting on intense geek love to raise support for the space program. From planet Earth, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Well, here in the U.S., women represent almost half of the labor force. But in the Palestinian territories, that number is far lower, which is where Maysoon O'Day comes in. She started a radio station to get more women into the workforce. She joins us now to talk about it from Ramallah. Welcome.
Hello.
Well, I noticed that right now women make up about 16.5% of the workforce there in the Palestinian territories, which is actually well behind the 26% average for the rest of the Middle East and North Africa. How do you account for that?
I think it's a weak economy in general. It's dependent very much on donor aid. So if there are some restrictions on access to this foreign aid, this affects the employment of men and women, but specifically women in this case. I would also attribute this possibly to some cultural restrictions. We have a patriarchal society. Men are the breadwinners. In certain cases, we have also women who are the breadwinners. But still, we see that males are still dominating senior positions, especially in the private sector.
Well, obviously, you don't have to convince me of the power of radio, but tell me why you decided to start a radio station as opposed to, a business or an organization that would try to help women become empowered in that area.
Yeah, the reason why it's radio specifically is because radio is accessible to everybody. As we know, it's a cheap medium.
Yep.
We like to target women in refugee camps or villages because our social mission is directed towards women in those areas. Such societies have radios. It is very personal medium. You can have your radio in the car. You can have it while you're having your shower. You can have it while you're preparing your dinner. So it's all over.
Well, and of course, radio knows no borders. So do you have listeners in Israel?
Of course, it knows no borders. I mean, listen, by default, we hit Israel as other Israeli radio stations reach the West Bank. We do not have any Israeli listeners because we broadcast in Arabic, but we do have possibly, or maybe certainly, some Arabs who live in Israel.
Now, I mentioned at the beginning that women make up 16.5% of the workforce there right now. Mm-hmm. What do you think you can get it up to with the work of your radio station?
I mean, listen, firstly and foremostly, what we're trying to do, yes, increase the number of women in media in senior positions, encourage the public and private sectors to absorb more women in the workforce, given that they are very educated, given that we have lots of qualification for that. Let's hope for something like 25% or even 30% if we can do that. After all, we are 50% of the society.
Maysoon O'Day, who is the founder and CEO of Nisa FM in Ramallah, thanks very much and best of luck with your station.
Thank you, Jeremy, and thank you very much for hosting us.
And finally, to Georgia, where two young girls got lost in the forest earlier this week and were found and rescued by their neighbor's Chihuahua. That's really all you need to know. I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.